Good morning, everyone. Happy Easter. Although this is a Buddhist center, of course, the Easter story is essentially about the universal human experience on the spiritual path, and about how love is bigger than death. And in Zen, we have a saying, life is not killed, which is basically the essence of the story. It's a good story. I think we need to be reminded often how life is not killed, how love is bigger than death, because of how deeply we collectively believe in separation. How deeply we believe in loss. How easily we forget the truth of our interconnectedness. So, happy Easter. So this morning I'm talking about a story from the life of Ryokan. Some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with this story. It's relatively common in Zen circles. Ryokan, for those of you who don't know, is a Japanese monk, Zen monk, and a poet. And he got much of his fame through the writings about his life and his poetry. I'm sure at least half of you here today have heard of Ryokan. And the story is a relatively famous one. Whether it's apocryphal or not, I couldn't tell you. It's a beautiful story, so it represents truth, whether it's factually, historically accurate or not. And it's on my mind because I used it during a retreat I was leading a few months ago, a Lectio Divina retreat, where you take a short passage of scripture or poetry or something and you spend quite a lot of time with it in silence, sort of letting it move through you, learning to read in a different way, learning to read for, we say, transformation, not information. So the point isn't to remember the details of the story. The point is to have a word or a phrase enter your heart and speak to you, right? To speak to you about your life. So I offered this piece to this group, and I was amazed at how much they found in it. They loved this story. None of them had heard it before. It was a Christian retreat, and they just loved it. They found so much in it. And so I thought, oh, there's a talk there. There's a talk there. So I made a bunch of notes during our conversation at the end of the day about all the stuff that had kind of come to the surface for folks. I'll offer some of those thoughts today. You'll probably find a lot more in it than I'm able to mention this morning, but the short version is, for me at least, and what I find in it is that it's a story about the radically transformational potential of Zazen. The radically transformational potential of the contemplative path, the meditation path that we do here. Self-relinquishment is essentially what this is about. So see how it feels for you today. The story itself is on the cover of the programs, and some of you got those, I know, this morning, and some of you didn't. So I'll read it aloud for those of you who do not have a program. It's quite short. One evening, a thief visited Ryokan's hut, only to discover that there was nothing to steal. Ryokan returned and said, "You have come a long way to visit me, and you should not leave empty-handed. Please take my clothes as a gift." The thief was bewildered. He took the clothes and slunk away. Ryokan sat naked, gazing at the moon. "Poor fellow," he mused. "I wish I could have given him this beautiful moon." So I'm just going to work my way through it. But there's already there's a feeling to the story, isn't there? There's just a feeling tone to it that I love. And everything I'm about to say is going to ruin that. So I just want you to touch that before I start talking. Even if you didn't spend any more time thinking about it, which I would encourage you to do, just to let those words roll around, and it gives you a feeling. There's just a feeling that comes through this story. This person visiting, finding nothing. Oh, here are my clothes. Take these. I wish I could have given him the moon. End of story. So everything I'm going to say is extra. But that's what I'm here to do. So I'm going to start with the label label thief. One evening, a thief visited Ryokan's hut, only to discover there was nothing to steal. A thief. So that's an interesting label, isn't it? A thief. What makes a thief? What is a thief? Being a thief is a condition of the heart-mind. A condition of the heart-mind. In the Buddhist precepts, the Buddhist precept against stealing is, I vow not to take what is not given. I vow not to take what is not given. So to take what is not given is a violation of that precept. That's what makes a thief, so to speak. And by that definition, all of us here obviously are thieves, or at least we have been at one point or another. Obviously, everyone has taken something that wasn't offered freely. It just happens all the time. Whether it's a physical object, most of us have stolen physical objects at some point in our lives. You know, a pack of gum you take when you're 3 and you don't know better, or the $20 bill from dad's wallet when you're 16 and you do know better. Or whatever your example is. That's one example. The long lingering glance of desire, attachment, lust. That's a way of taking. That's a way of stealing. To take what is not given. When you start investigating this precept, you find it's really, really deep. It goes on and on and on and on. There's a lot there. So we've learned that this person visiting him is a thief. And we get really used to looking at the heart-mind in Zazen. That's our meditation here in Zen Buddhism. We get really used to looking at the state of the heart-mind. And we get really good at watching when thievery arises, when greed arises, when grasping arises. We get good at seeing it because there isn't anything else to do. In case you haven't sat Zazen before, there's not a lot to it. It's pretty open space. So when stuff like that arises, ta-da, it's kind of high lit. Does that make sense? It's lit up from the back. Ah, I'm grasping. I'm greedy. I'm wanting to steal. I'm wanting to steal his posture. Look how good it is. I'm wanting to steal some time. Ah, I want this to go on. I feel so good. I want to steal 10 more minutes. Subtle sometimes, sometimes gross. Sometimes all that happens during Zazen is the parade of things you wish. When I get home, I wish I had this type of breakfast. I wish I could drive this car, kind of car home. I wish my spouse was like this. I wish my job was like this. Right? I want to take a whole bunch of things that aren't being offered to me. We get really good at seeing this. And, I looked for this story, and I couldn't find it in all of my books. But there was a great story I read once about a bunch of Zen monks going through the meal line, and they were being served by the Tenzo. They were all getting soup, so they're going through the line with their bowl, and the Tenzo's got the ladle there and is giving them all soup. And the abbot, you know, the master, the Zen master, is going through there, and they're all going through the line, and all of a sudden he just yells, "Thief, thief, thief!" And they're like, "Oh my God, who, where, what, who? And he's like, "Me! I'm really hoping that when it comes to me, the Tenzo reaches all the way down to the bottom of the pot and gives me the thickest, best ladle full, because I'm really hungry." That's the story. So he's calling himself out. Oh my God, I'm a thief. He sees it in his mind. I'm wanting to take something that isn't being offered. That would mean you would get less. I'm seeing the seeds of that in my own heart. I see the thief in me. So what this raises is the question, why do we become thieves? Why do we grasp? Why do we want and sometimes even take that which is not offered to us freely? And the answer, of course, is because we have a sense of lack. We have a sense of deprivation. If that Zen master wanted the biggest ladleful, because he's hungry, right? He's hungry. He feels deprived. He feels a sense of lack. And sometimes this sense of lack in our lives is real. Sometimes we do lack. Oftentimes it's imagined in this culture for these times. For most of us here in the room, it's usually imagined, usually an imagined sense of lack. But it does create in us a mind state of greed. Does that sound familiar to you guys? Is it tracking? Good. You're an honest bunch. Yes, it should sound familiar. All of us have already experienced that today, at least a dozen times. Big ways or small, this is just the nature of mind. So we have a meal chant, a series of meal chants we do before breakfast and lunch during our formal session here at Zen Center. And one of the lines we chant is, "We regard greed as the obstacle to freedom of mind." That's what we're talking about. We regard greed as the obstacle to freedom of mind. It's just the second noble truth is all we're talking about. The next time you don't feel free, the next time you feel afflicted, the next time you feel grasped or held in a constricted space by desire or grasping, just ask yourself, am I being greedy? Is there something I want? Something I need to be different right now? Of course. Of course. Greed immediately limits. Immediately limits our fundamental freedom of mind. So we also have an idea, and of course this thief has an idea too in the story, that there's such a thing as owning, that something can become ours. Something can become ours. And maybe the thing I desire is currently someone else's. It doesn't belong to me. It belongs to someone else. And again, this goes back to that deeply held belief I was talking about that we have in separateness. We really deeply believe in the separateness of objects, the separateness of people, the separateness of self and other. The only way I can get greedy and desire something is if I believe it's separate from me. So to be a thief involves desire, to be a thief involves believing in separateness, to be a thief also involves an unconscious or perhaps conscious, but either way it involves a placing of one's own perceived needs above the needs of what we imagine as the other. And we do this too. We just do this all the time. Putting our own perceived needs above those of another. Notice this the next time you're merging onto the freeway. Just notice. Who's going to make room for my car? So a thief comes and he finds there's nothing to steal. Nothing to steal is a really interesting phrase. The story doesn't say, and of course I don't know what this was originally in Japanese, so who knows what the translation is. But the story doesn't say there was nothing in the hut. It doesn't say the hut was empty. It said there was nothing to steal. So we can guess maybe his hut was empty. We can guess maybe he had some simple possessions, but nothing that would have value on the streets. You know, there's no stereo system there. It's just a robe and a bowl and some books and paper and da-da-da, maybe. But to have nothing to steal is an interesting phrase. Nothing to steal. So to possess nothing is part of the Buddhist path, the Zen path, to possess nothing. To possess nothing is to have nothing to steal. And Ryokan possessed nothing. And again, we're seeing a relationship here between our desire to possess and how free we are. The less we attempt to possess other objects, other people, the less we attempt to possess experience, the less we attempt to possess emotional states, that kind of stuff, the freer we get. I know we've all had the experience of being in a wonderful place at the right time and feeling contented and joyful. Wow. I wish this would never last. I wish I could just hang on to this and possess it and have it. Oh, shoot, I ruined it. It's gone. Poof. The spaciousness I was just feeling has just gotten a little smaller because I tried to hang on to it. That handful of sand just got smaller because I gripped it a little more tightly. Ryokan possesses nothing. And so in that moment, when the thief is there and there's nothing to steal, is he still a thief? I don't know. Is thief an abiding condition? We said it's a condition of the heart. It's a condition of the heart-mind. Right? We say heart-mind in Zen. If there's nothing to steal, are you still a thief? Is it about the intention to steal? The fact you've stolen in the past, perhaps? There's nothing to steal. So is that condition still abiding for this person? Is any condition abiding? Have you ever had a mind state, ever, that didn't go away? Ever in your life? Never had a thought that didn't leave, a feeling that didn't leave? You know, if we've agreed we're all thieves, we've all stolen at one point or another, are you a thief? Is that abiding? I don't know. We've all experienced anger in this room. Are we all angry people? Everyone in this room has lied. Are we all liars? The question here is, what makes us what we are? What makes you what you are? Or actually, more accurately, what makes you what you imagine that you are? And Buddhism, of course, posits you have no abiding qualities at all. You can't find one. Or at least we're encouraged to find one. Maybe you're the unique one. I would encourage you to look. The Buddha's pretty clear about that. He doesn't say you didn't have any. He just said, I've looked for these things in myself and I can't find any. I can't find a single abiding quality. I can't find a single abiding state. So that's interesting. That means in this entire, whole, vast universe, there is nothing to steal. When greed arises, do I become a thief? When that desire passes, do I become not a thief? It's interesting to look at these things. Zazen is a perfect laboratory in which to look at these things. How we define self. The changing weather of heart and mind. How it feels when we're the thief. How it feels when I want to steal. How it feels when I want to grasp. How that feels. And how it feels when that passes. When I relinquish it. How that feels. We learn a huge amount by just watching that experience. That's one of the things Zazen is so brilliant at doing. So there's nothing to steal. So Ryokan comes home and finds the thief here and says, oh, poor guy, you've come all this way to visit me and you have nothing. Please take my clothes. Please take my clothes as a gift. So the thief comes to the hut looking for objects, obviously. He's looking for items to steal, items of worldly value, and that's what he leaves with. However humble they are, however little street value I'm assuming a change of clothes has, he doesn't leave with much. I mean, if he's hoping for, like, you know, gold candlesticks or something like in Les Mis, he's in big trouble because he's leaving with a change of clothes that's worth about a buck. But anyway, he comes looking for objects, he leaves with objects. That's what he gets. So Ryokan meets him where he is. Ryokan gives him exactly what he asked for. He gives him what he wants. Be careful what you wish for, as the old saying goes. Be careful what you wish for, you may get it. So, why does Ryokan feel he can give away what little he has? Again, we don't know what's in the hut, but we assume it's not much. And if Ryokan's compelled to take off his clothes and give him an outfit, why does he do that? Why does he feel he can give that away? Why does he feel he can give away that one thing? And we know about Ryokan from his other poetry, from the stories about him. His practice is very deep. He's a tremendously tender, deeply compassionate person. He just has a giant heart. It aches for the suffering of the world. It wants to include everything for healing. He's kind of a famous softy, to use our terms. He's like just a famous softy. So it's fun to read about him. He's a self-professed fool. He's the great fool. Because he'll just keep letting you in. He'll just keep letting you love him. He'll just keep loving you, despite all the reasons not to. And he heads off into the village to play with the kids and gets distracted because, look, snow! And he spends his whole day playing in the snow with kids instead of going to beg for food or instead of whatever. So very, very simple. Zazen does that to us. It makes us very simple if we let it. If your Zazen practice isn't making you more simple, you might want to look at it. It really is designed to do that. Now, I'm not stupid, not dumb. I'm not talking about that. Simple. More able to be pierced by wonder, by joy, more spacious, more inclusive, more easily arrested by our experience of joy, of sadness. Zazen is, When it's done well, it's particularly effective at just making us much more kind of human, just more deeply human, less distracted by the flotsam and jetsam of consciousness, and just more available to our experience, more intimate. So we are more likely to get distracted playing with kids or playing in the snow, or, you know, because we're so used to returning to the simplicity of just this experience, just this, letting it all the way in, that we get good at that, right? Our skin kind of gets thinner in a sense. Chosen position of vulnerability. There's something beautiful about that. So anyway, Ryokan in that moment is moved by this guy. Oh, you came here wanting things. Here, take these things. I'll give you these things. He has a deep awareness, a very deep awareness of non-separation, the non-separateness of self and other, the non-separateness of self and object, the non-separateness of reality, the fundamental non-separateness of reality. Now, that's enlightenment, basically. A lot of folks have described the enlightenment of the Buddha as just a deep and penetrating experience of non-separateness. That's just one way of talking about it. But I like that. I like non-separate. It includes no past, no future. It includes no self, no other. It includes all sorts of stuff. But non-separate's a wonderful way of talking about it. So he has a deep awareness of non-separation. He has a deep awareness of interpenetration. He understands no self. He understands the emptiness of things. So this impulse is going to arise in him very naturally. I don't know that, and I don't think that, it doesn't feel to me like he's offering this guy some sort of teaching. I don't imagine him going, oh, I really should probably give him something because I got to be a good monk here. What's a good monk going to do? No, I just don't, it doesn't feel consistent with the tone of the story. This feels more to me like a spontaneous act. The way you'd give a kid your last piece of gum before you even thought, oh, this is my last piece of gum. You just be like, oh, you're looking for a piece of gum, sweetie? Oh, here, I've got one. Just give it to him before you thought about it. So Ryokan has everything to give. He possesses nothing. We know that. He possesses nothing, which means he has everything. He has everything to give away. He has seen through things. He has seen through self. He knows there is no lack, and that's the place he's coming from. Most of us, most of the time, come from a place of lack. We come from a belief in lack. This is usually not a conscious belief, but it's sort of our operating system. I am lacking and I need. I'm deprived and I want. Right? This, that longing we get, that craving that we get. He's coming from another place. He understands no lack. He understands abundance. That's the opposite. The psychology of lack, the problem of lack, the opposite of that is abundance, the psychology of abundance. Knowing there's no lack anywhere. There's an infinite amount to give because there's an infinite amount. You've had this feeling. This is not reserved for Zen people or enlightened people. You've had this feeling. You've had moments of understanding that. Everybody's had those feelings. Of just seeing, just looking around and going, oh my God, it's just abundant. It's everywhere. It's everything. There's nothing to hang on to or grab. There's just an infinite amount. The more I give, the more there is. It just keeps happening. It isn't even mine. It isn't even giving. What would that be? Right? Just abundance. You see it. You have moments when the veil goes away from your eyes and you see it clearly. And you see, this is abundance. You usually see this when your heart's really still. When your mind's really still. When you're content. You see this. And again, content isn't getting your own way. Content isn't you're always comfortable. Content is just when you don't need anything to be different. And just for a few minutes you realize, I don't need anything to be different right now. And I'm whole, and the world is whole. Everything's whole. And you just see, there's not a problem. There's nothing missing, there's nothing broken, there's nothing falling down. This is one of those moments. We don't stay in that place, and that's fine. It's very fine that we don't stay in that place. We have to balance those awarenesses with our everyday life, the way of the way of working and living in the world to be of greater service, we have to understand that, conventionally speaking, there are things called ownership. There are things called lack. There are things called deprivation. They're very real. They're very, very real. But one of the things practice does for us is it reminds us there's another dimension. There is something else, too. We get so fixated on the relative that we forget. We can get kind of claustrophobic if we stay in the relative all the time. So the absolute, the infinite, is what we spend a lot of time on in Zen, because we need that ventilation. We need those big spaces to remind us of our inheritance as humans. And that is our Zazen. That is exactly our Zazen. And I know we don't always experience it as spacious. I know we don't always experience meditation as contentment. I know we certainly don't always experience meditation as necessarily even pleasant. Oh, that's fine. It's not a problem. But we do always experience meditation as watching self arise and letting it go. Watching self arise and letting it go. Watching desire to possess, own, control arise and letting it go. We see the difference. We experience the difference. There's something profound there. And as we give ourselves to the practice over time, it begins to transform the heart. And increasingly we touch with our own experience the freedom that's just inherently there. Every time I relinquish self, there's just freedom. It's just always there. When you're selfless, you're infinite. Right? When you're selfless, you're infinite. Obviously. That's what Zazen is. Giving away self, moment after moment. Becoming infinite. Becoming what you already are. So the thief has his clothes, and it says he was bewildered, and he took them and slunk away. So again, is this thief still a thief? And in this moment, at least, no, he isn't, because he hasn't taken anything that wasn't freely given. Take my clothes as a gift. You came in this hut as a thief, you are leaving as not a thief. That seems fair to say. And what he decides to do the rest of his day, the rest of his week, the rest of his life is his own business. What he did in the past is his own business. But in this moment, you came in here with grasping, wanting to steal, and I've given you something. You are no longer a thief. He doesn't say that, that's just implied. Right? The thief is bewildered by this. Makes sense. This doesn't make any sense what just happened. Right? I mean, by conventional standards, Ryokan's response to this guy makes no sense whatsoever. But that's what happens. So he's bewildered, of course, and he slunk away. So there's a big word here, slunk. It's also really fun to say, slunk. I would recommend you repeat it to yourself 10 times in a row in the car on the way home. Slunk, slunk, slunk. It's fun to say. I'm not sure it's even a real word. Anyway, the translator here used the word slunk. And it is a key word, despite my kidding around, because that means he's leaving feeling ashamed. Right? When do you slink? When do you slink? You're not proud. Whatever it is you're doing, you're not proud of it. You slink. Am I right? I'm taking it from your laughter that you're recognizing what I'm saying here. We slink when we're ashamed. We slink when we don't want to be seen. We slink when we want to be invisible. And we get why, right? Ryokan, in this moment, meets his thievery, or his intent to steal, with generosity. So he sees his greed. The thief sees his greed, and he's ashamed of it. Ryokan's generosity is a mirror, and it just shows him his greed, and he's ashamed. Of course he's ashamed. Wouldn't you be like, I'm going to rob this guy blind. Oh, there's nothing there to steal. Take my clothes. You'd be like, what just happened? Oh my God, who am I? What have I done? And look who I was about to do it to. This guy just showed me his heart. He gave me his clothes. I was going to rob him blind. What has happened to me? Who am I? Can you imagine him kind of having an existential moment, right? Leaving going like, what just happened? I just looked in a mirror. Oh, man, I did not like what I saw. Of course he slunks. Of course he slunk. Poor guy. Ugh. Difficult. Very difficult. Very difficult. That's also one of the functions of zazen. I have a pet theory that is one of the reasons people don't stick around very long. What I mean is, you know, they come to meditation and go, oh, meditation's supposed to be really, really cool. I've read a bunch of stuff online. It's super trippy. It'll be awesome. So I'm going to stick with this, and you do it for a few weeks, and you're like, well, this is sort of okay. I feel sort of maybe more mellow. I don't know. Maybe just not being online for half an hour at a time makes me feel better. But after a while, you know, sort of the novelty wears off and sort of the, you know, trippy thing wears off. And after a while, it's a mirror. I'm sitting here and staring in a mirror. And I don't want to stare in a mirror. I don't. So I stop. Because if you do zazen, you see greed arise over and over and over. Over and over and over. Over and over and over. Desire. Anger. Hate. Frustration. Prejudice. Over and over. It's hard to look at that. We don't want to see it. The looking at it with kindness is the thing that transforms it. But that doesn't make it easy. Right? So it's like the fuel for our practice has to come from someplace deeper than I want to have a super pleasant experience for 30 minutes, so ring the bell and go. It has to be coming from something deeper. I am willing to see whatever shows up. I'm willing to be kind to whatever shows up. I'm here to transform heart-mind at a root level, and therefore, it's a blank slate. Anything goes. If greed shows up today, hello, greed. Hello, anger. Hello, feeling of lack. Hello, hunger. Hello, prejudice. There you are again. I see you. I'm not running. I'm just looking. Hello. I'm not possessing you either. Right? I'm not possessing the idea that I mustn't contain you because I'm so pure. No, no, no. And I don't have to hang on to you either and go, oh, that's me, that's me, that's me. I'm a greedy, awful, possessive, prejudiced person. Nope. They're not abiding. They're going, going, gone. Going, going, gone. Right? Isn't that the point of meditation? To just see it, see it, see it. Wow. Wow, we become so much bigger. So Ryokan's generosity in that moment showed that thief his greed. He's not a thief anymore, even. But this is one of the benefits of being, I almost want to say confronted, but I'll say shown. Being shown practices, being shown reflections, being shown people who embody something, whether we aspire to be them or not, anything that acts in our life as a mirror, we see the benefit of that. And we also start to notice how we avoid them because we don't want to see them. So it's kind of like why we're sort of slow to swear in front of a nun or something. Like, I kind of don't want to swear in front of you because you'd just by you being all nunny and stuff, you'd be like reflecting that behavior back to me, and I don't want to see it, so I'm going to wait till you leave, and then probably. Isn't that interesting? Like, we really want our behaviors to go out into the void, sort of shoot the arrows in the dark, but we don't like to sort of go, is that what I just did? And so if I'm hanging out with my buddies and swearing, I'm not seeing it, but if the nun's there, it's like, oh, whoops. So that's interesting, right? And if nun doesn't work for you, for whatever reason, use your grandma or whatever, you know that person, you all have that person, so. The person that reflects the thing that you are back to you. It's a great gift, but we don't always see it as such. So, it's also why we tend to socialize, hang out with people who think the same way we do, feel the same way we do, not challenge us in that way. And if we're fortunate, we hang out with folks who stoke our aspiration to be better. We hang out with people who act as mirrors to us and not people who help us become more complacent. Does that make sense? It's kind of a stick with a winner sort of thing. Anyway, you know what I mean. So, the thief has slunk away and now Ryokan is left alone in his hut. He sat naked gazing at the moon. Right now Wanda is up on the third floor teaching zazen. That would be like the best, six-word zazen instruction ever. She could make the class really just short by going, sit naked, gaze at the moon. That's really good zazen instruction. Sit naked, gaze at the moon. Sit naked and gaze at the moon. So, of course, in the story, because he's actually given away his clothes, there's a literal naked, but this is, zazen is about not shielding ourselves from anything. That's sitting naked. I'm naked. I'm not shielding myself from anything. Don't bring yourself to the zafu. Don't bring yourself to the cushion, to the chair. Don't bring yourself. That's to say, don't bring your defenses, don't bring your habits, don't bring your what. And of course, you do anyway. You do because you have to. But the idea is to sit naked. When you see the self show up, let it go. When you see the defenses show up, let them go. The habits, let them go. The agenda, let them go. The old diatribe, the old label, I'm a thief, let it go. I'm not a thief. I'm going to bask in my own purity. Let it go. Whenever self shows up on the cushion, please just let it go. You didn't come to the cushion for that, right? You came to the cushion for something bigger than that. So sit naked and gaze at the moon. So it's all the moon. Of course, this is Zen. It's all the moon. The moon is the metaphor in Zen literature for enlightenment. So when Ryokan is sitting naked and gazing at the moon, Zen students just nod and go, yeah, that makes sense. Sit naked, gaze at the moon. That's what we do. That's our jam. Here at Zen Center, in a literal sense, we face the wall when we sit. Usually on Sundays we don't, but usually face the wall. Well, there's the moon. When you sit at home, if you face your altar, face the wall, face the center of the room, you're facing the moon. When you're stuck in traffic and you find yourself getting constricted and you choose to let that go, return your awareness to body and breath, you're gazing at the moon. The moon is just original enlightenment. It's fundamental enlightenment. And if we think of enlightenment as, you know, enlightenment, light is the center of that word. If we think of enlightenment as a continuation of that first light, right, the one light, the only light, the Big Bang, the great flaring forth, the one light, there is only one light, thinking, well, then it's easy. Original illumination, this idea of enlightenment doesn't become some abstract, you know, spiritual thing, because it's just reality. You can't gaze at anything else, right? That's just science. That's fact. Everything comes from that one thing. You can only look at the one thing. You can only look at the one light. There is only the one thing. It's just truth. And that is our zazen. We become used to seeing how our mind overlays our experience with filters, and we get better and better at removing those filters and letting them go. And we start to see the light that shines through everything. There is only the one light. And it shines through the wall, and through the person sitting next to you, and through the thing you love, and through the thing you hate, and through the floor, and through the wall, and through your back pain, and through your aspiration, and through your longing. It doesn't care. There's just the one thing. It's the original face. Our face before our grandparents were born. The face of God, or of no God, doesn't matter. You know, when we sit zazen in Soto Zen, we leave our eyes open, as you know, kind of cast our gaze downward. It's a very soft, kind of half-open sort of gaze. And we regard everything within the field of that vision equally. You know, it isn't to like focus on the one spot at the expense of everything else. It's just, and I've heard this described as mountaintop gaze. If you've ever been at the top of a mountain, or even in the top of a building really high up, any kind of long view from a high place, it's a very soft gaze. You sort of take all of it in. You sort of just, wow. Valleys and mountains and deer and trees or whatever happens to be within the field of your vision, you just take it all in equally. It's very soft. Isn't that cool? What that means is you're not picking and choosing. Like, that's the good thing and not that. Ooh, I like that and I don't like that. You just take all of it in. That's the kind of gaze we have when we're doing zazen, whether we're looking at the floor or the back of somebody sitting in front of us like on a Sunday, or whether we're just gazing at the wall. All of it equally. It's a gaze. Gazing at the moon. We see it all at once. And the zafu is our mountaintop. And as I said, the moon is everything. The moon is everywhere. So that's what Ryokan's doing. And then it occurs to him during his zazen, perhaps after his zazen, poor fellow, I wish I could have given him this beautiful moon. So poor fellow is interesting because Ryokan's response to seeing this person's condition of heart, seeing the person's mind, this mind of grasping, this state of being a thief, his response is empathy. His response is compassion. It isn't anger. It isn't pity. He's not putting himself in a one-up. He's not separating himself from that guy. He's really pierced by this guy's state. He really has compassion for him. And why? Because he knows that greedy feeling. He's been a thief. We've all been a thief. He knows that feeling of being greedy, that feeling of being ashamed, of slinking away. God, that's a horrible, isn't it? I wouldn't wish that on anybody. Slinking, isn't that the worst thing? I'm so bad. I can't think of a worse feeling than that. Of course he has compassion. Of course his heart's broken for this guy. You're in such a state that you're going to take something from someone else because you think that'll help. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. Right? His heart is just broken. And of course he knows those feelings. And the thief left with what he wanted, things. That's a pretty sad answer, pretty sad ending to the story. So his heart is breaking for this guy. And that's wonderful. It's what Ryokan's famous for. And there's a reason Ryokan is held as an exemplar of Zen practice. Because if this practice does not break your heart, you're not doing it right. If this practice does not crack you open with compassion for those, including yourself, who are caught in suffering, you're doing it wrong. And if you're not moved as a result of your practice to try to free those beings who are caught in suffering, including yourself, you're doing it wrong. We only practice for the benefit of all beings. We only practice for the benefit of all beings. That includes us and includes everybody. It is about letting the heart crack open and be moved from that place to do something that's helpful. You know? So when he says at the end, and this is the end of our story today, I wish I could have given him this beautiful moon. I wish I could have given him this beautiful moon. I wish I could have given him the mind of enlightenment that sees non-separateness, that vanquishes greed, that evaporates craving, right? That cuts away desire and delusion. I wish I could have given him this medicine for what I see is afflicting him, and I can't. I can't. I can't give you the moon because I can't possess the moon. Right? I can't possess it. I can't give it to you. No one can. Enlightenment can't be stolen. It can't be given. It can't be possessed. It doesn't belong to anyone. It can't be faced. It can't be turned away from. It's the mind of enlightenment. Right? It doesn't feel a certain way. It doesn't look a certain way. In other words, it can't be objectified. There's no there. There's no thing. It can't be separated. So it's like everything else, I guess. If you love a flower, don't pick it up. Because if you pick it, it dies, and it ceases to be what you love. So if you love a flower, let it be. Love is not about possession. Love is about appreciation. Mind of enlightenment is the same way. We can't pick it. But that would be our impulse, wouldn't it? If I thought I could can it, bottle it, attach a UPC code to it, wouldn't I? And Calvin and Hobbes, Hobbes says, if people could put rainbows in zoos, they'd do it. I remember laughing at that and then going, oh my God, that's not funny. That's true. We would do it. We'd do it in a minute. If I could put that sunset in a zoo, capture it, kill it, mount it, I'd do it. It's what we do with butterflies. It's what we do with animals. It's what we do with each other. Oh, you're mine now. Don't move. So, it can't be objectified. The mind of enlightenment can't be separated. So my question for you today is, if you had the mind of ultimate enlightenment right now, would you know it? We know it doesn't have to show up a certain way. We don't know how it looks. We don't know how it feels. We know it doesn't stay. We know it doesn't leave. If you had it right now, would you know it? Dogen, he's our founder in Japan of Soto Zen, says, do not think you will necessarily be aware of your own enlightenment. I absolutely love that line. Because every one of us, at least people who've been hanging out for a Zen Center, think, when I get there, I'll know. When I get there, I'll know. I know this ain't it. Because this is just me being a thief, and just wishing Peter would ring the bell, and me being a thief. That's really all it is. But later when I get there, I'll know, because this greed will never arise, and it'll be lofty and magic. I'll be able to shoot love to you from across the room and cure you of your leprosy, and I'll float, because it's going to be friggin' awesome. And I'll know because I'll be there, right? And there'll be a big tattoo on my head that says, I've arrived. And Dogen says, nope. So then it just throws you back on yourself and goes, well, what is this thing then? What is this thing? I'm gazing at the moon. Is this it? Is this actually it? So Zazen, the act of Zazen, the performance of Zazen, the art of Zazen, is realizing our fullness of mind. Realizing the fullness of the mind of Buddha, the mind of enlightenment, is the antidote to our greed, the delusion of our separateness, our sense of lack. It's just reminding us, whether we get it cognitively or not, and it actually doesn't matter whether you do or not, that love is bigger than death, that life is not killed. Self or no self, reality doesn't care, not a problem. We never obscure the moon, we never get in the way. You being a thief does not prevent you from being Buddha. Right? And that it's just here. Because Zazen is never about later, it's never about other, it's never about another place, another time, another person, another state. It's here. It's just here. It's this moon. It's this moon. And it has to be this moon because we can't find another. Right? Can you find another moon than this? Have you ever experienced another moon than this? And when you leave Zen Center later this morning, can you leave without this moon? Can you? Try, see what happens. All right. That's all I think I have today to share with you folks. But I thank you. I thank you for your attention. I rambled a bit, but we still probably have about 5 minutes or so. Anybody have something to offer? Maybe you know more about this Ryokan story than I, but if you've got a question, I'd be happy to. Please.
It seems though like the story is told between another person, like two people. And how I kind of interpret it was this thief is not an external being.
Mm.
I would say that this thief is something or an entity or an energy that Ryokan is very familiar with. And the thief came in. There's nothing to steal. And it's not this dimension of material things. It's mind dimension. And he acknowledges the presence of this energy. And acknowledges, all right, I'm going to look at the mirror. You've come a long way. For me, that's saying you've suffered. You've endured suffering on this path. Mm-hmm. We have to evaluate it again. So instead of scolding it, being harsh, critiquing, it's just self-acceptance and self-love. You're not leaving empty-handed. Here's shelter. Here's comfort. Here's compassion. That you, not external thief, that you as a being, that every being needs. Ryokan sat naked. And he mused, poor fellow. And I would say that's not saying, poor you, I feel bad. It's a muse, like, oh, here we are again. This dance.
Yes.
But then the reality of, like, being human sets into play. So coming back to this human dimension, I wish I could have given him the moon. A desire to give more. And it's like, you go back from being on this dimension to an external, with mind, loving, self-acceptance dimension. You go, oh, I wish I could have given the moon. Well, you gave him or her or whatever beyond that. It's beyond words. It's beyond the moon.
It's lovely. Does that make sense to folks? Are you able to hear her?
For me, it's okay. Not a sad ending. It's very opposite. Mm. It's being, the monk is being humble. Mm-hmm. I wish I could have given him more. Mm-hmm. But then he's being human himself. And I would say that the points in between, that state of, come, look at the mirror, that is the mindset of enlightenment. Mm-hmm. It's not a knowing, it's a feeling.
Beautiful. Very beautiful. I like it, yeah. I think, and I love what you said about regarding the thief with kindness. Regarding the thief with kindness, because we put so much emphasis when we're giving a Zazen instruction, especially on when the thief shows up in our own awareness, that desire, that we meet it with kindness and not with the stick. You know, we're very, very quick to like, no, I'm doing it wrong. No, that's not a good impulse. No, that's a bad impulse. You know, we shame it away. We chase it away. Again, subtly or grossly we do. And when we acknowledge, oh, there's neediness again. Hello. I see you. That's the transformative dimension of Zazen. So that part especially, I think. Thank you for saying that. I like it a lot. Did other folks have... I mean, there's so much in this story, of course. You're going to take away something completely different than what I did. I love that. I love that about it. But did other people... Julia.
You know, the degree or the sense of dissatisfaction is the right thing. And like a lot of life, you said, a lot of the cultures imagine life is not even real.
Yeah.
I sometimes feel like that. What I notice when I sit in Zazen a lot is I continuously feel these impulses. And they take form, like, oh, it's dissatisfaction with my job, or oh, it's a desire to like satisfy something like food wise, or it seems like you always project on some sort of craving or object. That impulse. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, like, does that impulse, does that, I mean, fundamentally,
the
teaching of that impulse comes from a sense of separation? And that's the desire to move into the future and move into somewhere else or to be experienced with something else.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that sense of separation? Mm-hmm. Yeah. My practice a lot is just sitting with that constant, watching that constant impulse come up. I'm like wondering, is it ever
going to
exhaust itself?
Yes.
And I just wondered what your experience
with
that or what the teaching showed.
Yeah. Great question. Did you guys hear that back there? Thank you. It's a universal experience. So just number one, no. This is exactly what we all experience in some degree or another. I'm seeing a lot of nodding. I'm assuming you all know that it's more or less a nonstop show of the thing that I wish or the thing that will be in the future or the nature of the dissatisfaction. Maybe it's my job. Maybe it's my kids. Maybe it's, you know, that sandwich in the fridge that will be the answer or whatever. You know, that it's this nonstop show. So I'm just wanting to normalize that because, I don't know, I think it took me probably a long time to realize, oh, I'm not a freak. Everybody in this room is experiencing that. I like to normalize that as much as I can. So I would say yes to both things that you're asking. One is that, yes, the practice is exactly as you describe it, which is, hello, I see you. I notice you're doing this. I notice you're wandering to the future. How might I problem solve about my job? How might I problem solve about the relationship? What's the thing that I really wish I could eat right now? And when you find yourself doing that, go, oh, I notice that that's happening. I see you, hunger, whatever. I'm letting that go and I'm coming back to this. So for that time on the cushion, 20 minutes, half hour, whatever, my practice is not to do any of those problem-solving things, but just to return over and over to just this. And what that actually involves, for most of us, is something very difficult because we're telling a story about how we wish things were. We're telling a story about how maybe we would solve something that we regard as a problem. And the instruction is let that go and come back to the actual experience. And the reason that's a tough sell is because if I'm feeling lack, if I'm feeling hunger, if I'm feeling dissatisfied, the instruction is, oh yeah, get really intimate with that. Don't tell yourself stories about it. Don't try to talk yourself out of it. Go back and really experience it. It's a tough sell. It's a tough sell, but by meeting that experience with kind acceptance, instead of distancing oneself from our experience, I don't give as much fuel to the problem solving. My problem is real. I really am separate. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. I'm giving much more of my energy, much more of my heart to this is how things are, and I'm big enough to be with them as they are. So I'm planting the seeds of compassion for self in a state of suffering, but I'm also planting the seeds of contentment. Because if I define contentment as not wanting anything to be different, I'm in that moment literally practicing. I notice how I want things to be different, and I'm going to stop. And I'm going to be with things as they are. And I'm noticing again how I want things to be different. I'm going to stop, and I'm going to be with things as they are. So that muscle gets stronger, in a sense. Does that make sense? But the second dimension of your question is fantastic, and you're exactly right. The second thing that's actually going on there subtly is I'm going from a place of separation to a place of non-separation. Because fundamentally, I can't want something unless I believe it is separate from me. Right? And Buddhism would say, you know, greed, hate, and delusion are the three poisons, the three things that cause us suffering, right? I want more of, I want less of, and I'm misunderstanding reality. Misunderstanding reality starts with, it's separate. You're separate. Right? It's the very first duality we learn when we come into form. There's a separate thing called me that isn't you. Oh, wow, now I've got a whole bunch of problems. I've got to protect this thing, make sure there's nothing bad ever happens to it, and make sure it lives forever and always looks fantastic in a bathing suit. I've got a lot of problems. You know, I got a lot of problems because I'm separate. You know, before we have separate, you know. So, non-dual meditation, which is to say Zazen, is, and we've talked about this before here, when I let go of the agenda, I let go of the narrative, and I just return to experience, for that instance, I'm going from self to non-self. I'm going from self to non-self, right? Because before there's a me and an in-breath and a my in-breath and a my boredom and a my whatever, there's just experience. So for just that second, right? No self. And then self shows up again. Hello, self. I see you, sweetie. It's okay. You're part of the deal. And then I let you go and I come back to no self. So we're actually addressing both things that you're bringing up at once. And it takes the form of just body and breath. Where's the experience of dissatisfaction in this body? The emotion of it and the physical feeling of it. Just being present to it kindly. Not feeding it, not chasing it away. I see you. Being kind to it. But at the same time, there's this other thing, magic, working behind the scenes, which is self, no self. Self, no self. And the more we do it, the better we get our capacity for self-compassion, for contentment showing up as things are okay as they are, is increasing. And also our capacity for understanding on some level, experiential or not, that reality is undivided fundamentally. And self will show up, that's fine. And it's useful to think reality is divided. It's just a necessary fiction. But it's cool to put ourselves in touch with the fact that it is just a fiction, too. So that's a great question. And forgive my long answer, everybody. I really wanted to riff on that. Was that helpful?
Yeah,
maybe just a little bit, yeah.
Well, that's what okay. I guess I kind of wanted to know. Yeah. I feel like somebody described it once, like, practices resting and awareness.
Yeah.
And not being caught up or watching it go.
Yeah.
But I guess what I really noticed is how this impulse is just keeps arising, arising, yep. arising, arising. And it's kind of like, gosh, I just wish it would finally pass itself out.
Well, the good news is, in the end, yes, because fear, what you're describing, is always about a constriction. Fear is a function of physicality.
Yeah.
So, of course, it's limited.
I mean,
it's finite.
I think that's what my thought was. It all comes from fear.
Yeah, separateness. Yeah, separateness gives rise to fear. So, yes, it is finite. That's the good news. And I know we're running out of time, so please, Peter, do announcements. I'm sorry. Thank you all very much.